Welcome, everybody, to the next episode of Magical Musings. Your hosts are here, Joy and Brian, and since I introduced him last time first, I'm going to introduce myself first. Today, we're going to be talking about everything that the 101 books don't talk about, so that y'all can get a better idea of what else is going on. So come on in, we're going to have a good time. Alright, today's episode is going to be on Ostara. We've been trying to go through the various holidays as we go around them during the Wheel of the Year, and this is the next one up. So, let's see. Tell you what, Brian, why don't you go ahead and say what you want to say about Ostara, and I'll figure out what I want to say.
All right, I agree. Well, basically, I mean, the whole concept of Ostara is basically that it falls at the time of the year of the spring equinox, and that in north, you know, in the northern half of the planet, northern hemisphere, you're dealing with sort of a period around March 21st, give or take. It's usually labeled the first day of spring, but because you can't really assign a calendar date to that, it's not usually. It's just kind of a day we've assigned. Basically, though, the idea behind it is that it's the period of the calendar year, I guess, where the length of days and nights is basically equal. Basically, the term equinox tells you that. And
equinox is Latin, by the way, for equal night. Nox is night, equa is equal.
This is true. And I mean, the same holiday goes by different names in different traditions. I mean, you'll hear it called Ostara, Eostra, Alban Eilir. Pantheists call it spring equinox, or the vernal equinox. Vernal coming, I think, from Latin, meaning green. So the green time equal nights. And I mean, the most common names that you'll hear referred to by among pagans is Eostra or Ostara, and those are both variations on the name of an Anglo-Saxon or Germanic goddess of spring. And so, yeah, I mean, that's a basic start on that.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the same stuff that's just to give you a good grip on what we're relating to. Now, it is one of the minor festivals. It's not a fire festival because it's a cross-quarter festival, as we said. It is, you know, called various things in various places. But what I've always found very interesting, to me at least, is that right around this time is generally where you also have the celebration of Easter. And a lot of the Ostara symbols and mythology and everything have leaked over into the celebration of Easter. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I don't really understand what the heck a lot of chicken eggs and rabbits have to do with the birth of Jesus. Because it doesn't.
Wow.
Well, or the death of Jesus, I should say, because that's the celebration that they're going through right now.
Death and resurrection.
Death and 40 resurrection.
40 days prior to that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I never really understood it as a kid growing up, because that's literally the problem, is that those symbols have nothing to do with it. You can argue that the symbols were put in because they have to do with rebirth and renewal, which is another way of saying it has to do with fertility, which is where you get right back into the fertility goddess and the renewal of spring. And looked at from that perspective, it still doesn't make sense because, I mean, come on, you've got eggs, which are chicken embryos, and you've got rabbits who, well, breed like rabbits. You know,
true.
So they have nothing to do with death and resurrection. You know, I could understand it if it was a specific species of tree, For instance, the dogwood, who, you know, blossoms at this time. The cherry trees, I could understand if those were symbols. But chickens and rabbits, those have to do with multiplying and being fruitful. Chicken embryos are, you know, chicken embryos. Each chicken... go ahead.
Sorry, it just occurs to me that okay, there are certain authors, among them I believe John Allegro and Jan Ervin, who relate the concept of Easter eggs to, in fact, tying back to our Yule episode, where we talked about the mushrooms. There's actually a phase of the development of the Amanita muscaria mushroom in which it actually looks like an egg sitting on the ground. And it's bright red, and it's got white spots on it, and it's this unnaturally colored egg sitting on the ground that leads to wisdom and this sort of magical experience of enlightenment kind of deal. And
so you
one
pick
of
up
the
this
things that
I was just thinking, you pick up this weird red egg sitting on the ground where no egg is supposed to be, and you eat it, and it puts you into a psychedelic trip.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, the idea behind the whole Easter egg hunt thing is actually, it relates again to the same thing, where, you know, at Yule, you're gifting kids with psychedelic mushrooms because of the whole thing we talked about that I won't go into again. You can check that out when I kind of gross people out in the Yule episode. But basically at the spring equinox, once, you know, the winter has passed, suddenly the mushrooms become available again. And the people who tend to be short enough to crawl under the trees to go hunting for the mushrooms are the little ones. So because you have the equation or the connection between bright red eggs, in quotes, under the trees, and you have little people with small hands and eager, you know, searching enthusiasm, you send the little children to go under the trees to find the eggs.
Here, honey, go get drunk.
The red ones, the blue ones, you know, all these other, you know, colors that relate to Easter eggs tend to relate to certain colors of different varieties of mushrooms. And all of them are, you know, psychedelic. So, yeah, I mean...
Why do you want to turn all of our celebrations into drug trips? I mean, come on.
Because people need to know these things.
Oh, Lord. That is an interesting thing. I'd never actually understood why you paint them, but that does make perfect sense when you look at it in the context of doing something like that. But the point was is that, you know, hens lay one egg a day. So if you have 10 laying hens and they're getting they're around a rooster a lot, you're going to get 10 eggs a day. So that's very prolific. Rabbits will clutch, you know, 10, 15, or at least 10, babies at a time. So that's another prolific. And they, you know, because of those, they both turn into being symbols of fertility. And so, and since Ostara is a fertility rite right around now, that's what this is. You know, this is a fertility celebration. It's interesting that all of the various symbols for fertility got pulled over into the Christian celebration. I think it's another example, if you want to look at it, a very clear example of the established or the religion trying to establish itself, co-opting symbols and celebrations and rites from the religion it's trying to replace. I mean, I can't really think of anything that's more clear than that.
Well, I think that, you know, you can look back through history, and I don't really think there's any unique holidays. I think everyone hijacks them from the previous tradition, and, you know, it just becomes a matter of what are the fun symbols that keep it interesting for various age groups.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, Easter eggs and all that kind of fun, you know, obviously gearing it toward the kids, you know, you've got the hidden subversive related nature of March hares and that sort of thing. And again, that does come under the whole fertility thing because mm-hmm. that's the time of the year when mating season begins for hares.
True.
So wild bunnies going crazy, making more little baby bunnies.
Domestic bunnies going crazy, making more little baby bunnies.
That's true.
You know, and then
this is true.
And then here's an irony that I think that some people notice, but a lot of people I think miss. Here you are going around, you are buying and presenting to your lover the sexual organs of various plants, and everybody just went, "What? What do you think
That's
flowers
true.
Are?"
That is true, actually.
Naked sexual organs of plants. And you want to talk about a clear, hey, let's fuck symbol? There you go. I can't really think of anything else.
Yeah, there's not really any sort of subtle thing about it. I mean, everything about Easter is fertility. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, I'm not even sure that there's a lot you can say about it. It's you look at different traditions related to things like the eggs. We talked about mm-hmm. those. You look at various animals, and it's always the cute little animals, right? Like mm-hmm. little chicks and peeps, marshmallow peeps, good stuff.
Oh my lord, I hate them.
Do you?
Yes.
See, I love those things. They're horrible.
I'm sorry. Sugar-coated, mash-molded, dried-out marshmallows with dye on them is like, okay, first off, marshmallows are good. They're wonderful. But then you dry them out, and they turn into little bricks. And then you pour sugar on top of them. I mean large sugar crystals, not the powdered sugar that they usually use. But then you put all the sugar on them and dye them. It's kind of like gilding the lily. You know, it's a little bit overboard. And then you have a shelf life on them of 6 years. And people still eat them after that time period. That's like, you know, it turns into a brick, a literal brick, and you can smash your teeth on them. So, yeah, no, I don't like peeps.
Fair enough. And actually, it occurs to me now that all of those, like, sprinkly colored or covered marshmallows relate back to the whole concept of gnawing on a mushroom that you freshly started on. Apparently, if you eat an Amanita muscaria mushroom off the ground, you bite into it, it's like biting the red outside and the white flesh of an apple or of a marshmallow candy thing that's got color on the outside. That's right. Everything relates to mushrooms now.
Oh, God.
Forget
okay.
tarot, people.
Yeah, forget tarot. We got mushrooms now. Okay. I take it you're talking from experience when you talk about all this with the mushrooms and everything.
It goes back to all my reading and videos about mushrooms. I can't say I've found any Amanita muscaria, although I do plan to go hunting this year. Mostly because I'm curious to know what it's like.
Your druggy days.
I just think that, you know, it's a little more spiritual and more significant to do the Amanita hunt and then, like, chowing down on the mushrooms
mm-hmm.
than it is to, like, do the common thing of, like, hey, here's a drug, you know, let's smoke a bowl or, you know.
Well, that's true, because then there's the, you know, finding it and everything like that.
Because it's a very ceremonial process, and I think that that's what's lacking in a lot of the other drugs that people use a little mm-hmm. too often. So, yeah, that's my own personal plan this year, is to go hunting for Amanita muscaria. They're supposed to be growing around here, so if I'm lucky, I'll get to talk about the experience of gnawing on a mushroom.
That should be very, very interesting.
It really, I'm hoping it will be. But anyway, Are there other things that we want to talk about with Eostra, Ostara, Spring Equinox, anything that we want to call it?
Well, I'm thinking that there's also, you know, just a few things that we need to touch on. One is, yes, they pulled a lot of traditions from the pagan celebrations to use in modern Christianity. But like Brian was saying, you know, every tradition pulls from other places. One thing that we kind of touched on a little bit that I do want to talk about is simply the gift of animals right around this time. You see in Easter baskets and in some celebrations, and especially with pagan celebrations, the cutely dyed little chicks and the cute dyed little rabbits that you can give to the children to raise, and they're cute and they're nice, and in 3 months, they're not so nice anymore. They're kind of getting big, and they're getting, you know, in everything. They're pooping everywhere, and they're causing, you know, disruptions because they're being, well, animals. I want to advise people, and I know you've heard it from every single side over the time, but I want to really stress, don't get an animal like this unless you have one of two mindsets. One, this is your pet as much as a cat or a dog or a fish or a bird. This is a pet, and you're going to hand raise it, and you're going to take care of it and take it to the vet, and, you know, take the responsibility of a pet that you give. Or if you're unwilling to do that, you treat it as you would a livestock animal for the pot. I mean, I realize that when they're tiny, baby bunnies are so cute. And believe me, the last thing that I could imagine doing is letting it grow up. And I can't imagine taking a small animal like that and with the mindset of killing it and cooking it. But that's what farmers do all the time. I mean, they, you know, buy livestock. The cattle are cute, and they take them home, and they refuse to let their children name them because they are going to wind up in the pot eventually. So you have to have the mindset of, okay, well, if we're going to be doing this, we need to just do it. And we need to make sure that we can put the animal down at the end of it and eat it, you know. And if you think about it and you start really considering it and looking at your own attitudes about it, this is not something that is necessarily a terrible thing in the tradition of paganism. I mean, you have the mindset of, yes, you have animals, and animals are here to use, and we're a rural thing, and so let's make sure that we can use the animals that we get and that are in our life in such a way that, you know, it's consistent with honoring the animal, taking care of the animal, and honoring the gods for letting us use this animal. Okay, because, you know, like anything else, the gods don't have to give you what you ask for. They can, you know, just do whatever. And if they decide that you're not going to have these animals, you're going to get an animal, and it's going to die, and you're going to get another animal, and it'll die, and you'll get a third animal, and it will die. And so, but yeah, so go into it with that mindset of either keeping it as a pet or raising it for the pot. Now, it's going to be hard. I'm not going to joke with you. You know, the only people that really do this on a consistent basis, you know, are people that live in rural communities. And they, you know, see animals as crops to be harvested, mm-hmm. just like the plants and things. So, yeah, the concept of bringing a rabbit in, bringing a clutch of rabbits in, putting them in a hutch inside, feeding them, playing with them, you know, talking to them, and then taking them out back and striking their head off, that's not a hell of a long concept. You know, it's going to hurt for a little bit, But they'll, you know, okay, well, we need this, and we need it more than we need to eat right now, so we're going to kill you, and we're going to eat you. That's, you know, the urban people, on the other hand, have a real hard time making that mental leap of, okay, we have an animal here. It looks like our cat, in fact. And she's there, and she's being irritating, and she's running around, and she's attacking everybody. Well, what do we want to do with it? You know, do we kill it? Well, no, that's horrible. That's terrible. That's outrageous. We would never kill an animal. What are you talking about? Well, you know what? Sometimes animals have to be put down. You know, and there's nothing wrong in my mind, you know, other than tradition, of having something like a cat that's causing a problem and then stewing it up later. I mean, it's a stretch, and a lot of people are going, "Ugh, yuck." No, I would not eat my pets. Okay? It would be very hard for me to do that. But if necessity came down to it, yeah, I would. I would be willing to. Or I would at least be willing to make it for somebody else.
And I think you make a good point there, because there is, I think, part of the whole concept of getting back in touch with these sort of earth-centered festivals and holidays is the idea of reconnecting yourself to that natural cycle of, mm-hmm. you know, where food comes from. Because when you go into a modern supermarket, basically you've got all kinds of meat and vegetables and fruit and, you know, any conceivable ingredient that you can come up with. And it's available basically all year. Mm-hmm. But that's not how food is traditionally made available. Like, you don't get, say, I don't know, fresh whatever. I don't know. I can't even think of an example offhand right now. But there are, you know, there are seasons in which most of the foods we have are available, right? Mm-hmm. You won't get lamb at a time when lambs aren't born, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone's into lamb. But the point is that
– cherries. Good example of this is cherries. Cherries are a seasonal fruit. The trees bloom now. They get impregnated now. They start developing the fruit right around May. The cherry prices in supermarkets are going to plunge because they're freely available and they're fairly abundant in the North American area. However, you also get this surge of incoming cherries somewhere around November as well. Why? Because that's the cherry season in the southern hemisphere, and they pull them up here. So you have cherries all around, and if you don't think about it, you think, oh, cherries are nothing. You know, we got them all the time. The, you know, the prices fluctuate, yeah. And you don't realize that it takes a lot to grow a cherry. You have to have a lot of trees to grow cherries, and then you have to ship them and import them and everything. And if there's a lot in the local area, yeah, you're going to get a lot of return. And the prices are going to go down. But if you're having to ship them from another hemisphere, then the prices are going to go up. So continue, Brian.
This is true. Yeah. And, I mean, the whole concept of gifting your children with Easter animals, at the very least, if you do decide that you want to do that, you know, make a point of stressing that this is a food animal in a lot of places, and that most people who raise these aren't raising them to be cute, fuzzy Easter pets. You know, like, they do become food because that's where food comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things you might want to do with your kids, just to kind of get back on track with the whole cycle of agriculture and nature, is to take your kids out to places where food animals or, you know, produce are produced, you know, and get them out there and let them see things in the process of becoming food.
Mm-hmm. And this is not...
I'm not suggesting...
Yeah, and not petting zoos, not zoos, captive zoos where you go and you look at the ostriches too, because those are in their own environments and they're there to be observed. Brian's talking about out to working farms, out to factory farms even, where the chickens are in individual cages above a ramp, where when they lay the egg lands on the ramp and it rolls down onto a conveyor. Okay, things like this, where the milk farms, where they're hooked up to the machines to suck the milk out of the teats. I mean, I know my daughter, when she came back from going to one of Purity's farms, was just astounded and jumping around and so excited because she learned that milk in the bottles come out of cows. She didn't know that. We had explained it to her. We had told her that. We said, oh, it comes from cows, you know, but I don't know what she thought it was doing, but she didn't understand the concept of how it comes out of the cows.
Exactly. Well, I think that's an important thing, right? Like, even the simple idea of baking bread, for example, I mean, people are so completely clueless about that. And, I mean, it just becomes so easy nowadays to go out and get something that you want, right? Mm-hmm. Like, people don't recognize the work that goes into making a loaf of bread. So, mm-hmm. you know, these are the kind of things that maybe your kids would benefit from, you know, seeing those farms. Maybe if they're old enough, you know, somewhere between 10 to 13-ish, it might be a good time to have them help out in making a chicken into food. Mm. Or something like that. It's a weird graphic experience for people, and it may trouble some people to even consider doing that. But this is part of daily life of being pagan, right? You know, you're trying to get back into the cycle of nature, connecting with not only our natural body cycles that, you know, deal with simplicity of night and day and that sort of thing, but the whole concept of the year, in which there is seasonal things that come about, right? Like, I mean, your food doesn't just happen in the supermarket. It's not just there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It has to go through the process of becoming food by growing and being harvested. And so, you know, part of connecting to that whole process is taking the tours of the places that you may not really like to see. It may be against your ethics to watch animals being slaughtered for food or, you know, whatnot. But if you're the type of family that eats meat, or, you know, if you happen to be vegetarian or whatever, I mean, go where your food is produced. Go to the places locally, the greenhouses, if you've got like greenhouse companies that offer tours, take a look through them, you know, see where produce comes from. Show your kids that the tomatoes that they, you know, eat in ketchup come off a plant, etc. I mean, there's a lot you can do with that, and it would all be very instructive.
Yeah, it can be. It can be incredibly instructive. You know, and it's... Brian mentioned that people don't realize just how much work goes into some of these things. And I was just thinking about this while we were talking a little earlier. There's a spice called saffron. A lot of people like saffron. It's a beautiful yellow dye. It gives a very, very interesting taste, and it's super expensive. And people don't understand why these few little grains of something, you know, cost $25. And the reason that it does is because this is the pistil of a saffron flower. And so you have to have fields of these things in order to get that one little stem to put into the jar with 10 other little stems. And these things are not the easiest to grow. So, okay, anyway. Yeah, learning where all this stuff comes from really does help out. It's a real education, and it's something that everybody can benefit from. I know I benefited from it myself at one point, and it was something that... It's, you have to really consider stuff. I mean, this would be, for a family activity, this would be a perfect time to actually sit down and explain the cycle of life, the interconnectedness of everything, how we are connected with the animals, how the animals are connected with us, how the really practical stuff. I mean, it's great to have a mindset where you've got a... I'm losing my train of thought here. Okay, where you've got a an idea of being wonderful and being good stewards of the earth, okay? There's a point where it goes from being a good steward over into being ridiculous. As an example, and this is an extreme example, there are a lot of vegans out there, and I've got a lot of people on my friends list who strive to eat nothing but vegetables. Because vegetables are plenty, they're plentiful, they're a renewable source. There's not nearly as much animal cruelty going into making them as a cash crop. And you can get all your nutrition and everything from vegetables. That's great. I have no problem with that. That's good on being a steward of the earth. Where it becomes insane is where they put their pets on the same diet. Cats and dogs are meat eaters. Their bodies are designed for intaking mass amounts of protein, digesting mass amounts of proteins, and getting rid of and using mass amounts of proteins. Okay? They don't do very well with vegetable matter. Putting them on an all-vegetable diet, they cannot get their resources. They could be eating all the time, all day, and they will never get the nutrition they need. They will starve to death, literally, with lots of food around them. Okay? Mm-hmm. This is where you have to understand these. You have to actually objectively look at nature. You have to objectively look at yourselves. You have to realize that you as a thinking, reasoning human being can take steps to do things for your own self that are good and that are positive and that are high quality. But you have to temper it all the time with the understanding that this is not a solution for everybody. This is not even a solution for everybody in your house. This is a solution for you and something that you decided to do. And it could literally be harming other people in your household for you to force this on them. Okay? I've got a lot of respect for people like Greenpeace and stuff like that. And they have an attitude that's right. Stop abusing the harvesting of whales, the harvesting of seals, the hunting of narwhals, and you know various things like that. Stop abusing that. Stop doing it where you're taking 50 whales a day so that you can chop them up and sell them and turn them into makeup. You know, take one or two. Let the species revive itself. But then you've got people like PETA who are, no, we need to go in and to the factory farms and release all of the cattle immediately without ever telling you, okay, here's the deal. We're going to blow up all the pens and the cattle are going to be roaming wild in the streets. What do we do then? They never have that next step because they only see the cruelty that's going on and they don't understand that in a very practical sense, a calf born into that kind of environment is going to be incapable of taking care of themselves once you release them. And it's one of those things that I keep pointing out to people, and they're like, no, it's instinct. And it's like, were you able to speak instinctually? It's a tool that you learned over time. Were you able to walk instinctually? It's instinctual to crawl. It's instinctual to have a four-footed stance. It is not instinctual to stand up, okay? In just about every case of wild childs that they find, where they're you know out in the woods, they were raised by wolves or apes or bears or whatever you want to call them, and they learned instinctually, separate from the society of Western culture, they're usually on all fours. they may get up right occasionally to do a specific thing like climb a tree or reach something that's high. But most of the time they're sitting on the floor, they're sitting in a squatted position, they're resting curled up, they're folded in on themselves. Because that's how you protect your vital organs, that's how you move efficiently through hard terrain, that's how you do a lot of the things that animals do. And the only example they have are the animals, so that's the instinctual reference. And understand the difference between instinctual and what is learned. It's learned to stand up. Think about how. Think about all the parents out there who spend days and weeks and months teaching their child to walk. If it's an instinctual process, yeah, they'll be able to stand up occasionally. Yes, they will be able to take a step or two and fall down. Yes, they see us walking around. But you still have to teach them and encourage them and let them practice. So, you know,
definitely.
Okay, and this would be a good time, this time period, your star time period, would be a really good time to get people in your community to understand the difference between being good stewards and being just as bad as the users that are out there, okay? One of the main objections, okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, too, that PETA, as a general rule, has fallen out of popularity among vegans because of the fact that while they are militant and even, you know, supportive of what most would call terrorist acts, they actually also fund the euthanasia of animals because they, you know, I mean, obviously you rescue a certain number of animals and there's only so much you can do with a bunch of animals, right? Mm. Like, again, it comes back to that, you know, they've acted without thinking about what to do with them next, right? So yeah. They end up having to put them down. And then, you know, they're like, wow, you know, like, basically they're pointed out as hypocrites.
I've had a personal beef with PETA for many, many, many years. And the more I hear about them, the worse they get. I started having a problem with them when I understood that PETA, as an organization, gives money to groups who are literally domestic terrorists to go out and destroy people's livelihoods, to destroy people's property, and to all in the name of saving the animals, okay? I have no problem with exposing and putting down those people who are abusing animals, okay? You see the, you know, colt that's chained by its ankle and it stands in one place all the time so that they can do pregnancy hormones for estrogen. And those types of abuses, and there's big sores on their leg extending from their knee to their ankle. And yes, those types of things are horrific, in my opinion. I mm-hmm. think that there is no excuse for them. There are multiple other ways to do it, some slightly more expensive, but not necessarily, once you adjust over to it. But for a group to go in and see, you know, a barn full of chickens who are wandering around on their own, who are not confined, who have their own nests and are there to be raised, to be slaughtered for meat. They're fed every day. They're, you know, taken care of. Some of them do get sick, as a large group, a large population of anything is going to. But they're taken care of. They may not be loved. They, you may, you know, shove them aside with your foot while you walk in there spreading the feed around. But to have somebody come in and say that that's animal cruelty is like, in what universe? No, they're not free-range chickens. But you have chickens in pens on farms all the time. You want us to have wild free-range chickens where you're going out into the forest and trying to find their nest and spending 10 hours a day to harvest 10 eggs? rather than having them all in one location where they're easily, you know, collected so that you're making more money? How is this wrong? There was a picture on Tumblr a while ago about a bunch of sows who had piglets. And the sows were in these pens that were diagonal to the square pen that they had been put in previously to give birth. And the sows basically were laying on their side most of the time. They could get up, but not too much. They couldn't wander around too much. Their heads were in a separate section that the piglets couldn't get to. And everybody started screaming about how cruel this was and how terrible it was. Okay? Well, somebody who actually farms pigs got on there and put on that picture that this is not cruel. This is saving the piglets' lives. Because the sows, once they've given birth, don't give a shit. They will roll over on top of their piglets and kill them. They will step on them. They will eat them. They will hurt them. They will refuse to let the piglets get to the teats so that they can get milk and such and grow. They will be pushed away from the sows so that they're not warm. So the whole point of this is to hold the sow in one position so that she's not going to kill the piglet. She can't get at the piglet to eat it, which is a standard thing for pigs to do. I mean, it's even in the mythology, the Cerwedan and the white sow who eats her own children. I mean, this is, you know, something that if you've studied mythology at all, if you've studied nature at all, you know happens all the time. This is how they, you know, keep the piglets alive so that the piglets can grow and become sows and become bacon and sausage and everything. You know, and this is only for a specific period of time, for like the first 5-6 months of the piglets' lives. It doesn't hurt the sow. They're let out. They're taken care of. Yes, they have some sore spots, but they're, you know, fixed. And, you know, the cycle repeats the next year. So, anyway. So, yeah.
Well, and I think that's part of the whole, you know, taking your kids on tours of places where food is produced. I mean, the reality of it is, I mean, I have a lot of vegan followers, and I love them dearly. But I think one of the big issues is that veganism relies too heavily on shock value instead of information. Propaganda coming from any angle is still propaganda. It's tweaked to serve the agenda of the propagandist. And so you're not going to hear about the actual practices going on. If you want to see those, if you want to justify yourself as a vegan, go out to the places that food is produced and see and ask questions. Don't rely on videos you've seen on YouTube. Don't rely on books that you've read that were recommended by fellow propagandists. You know, go out and see for yourselves where food comes from. Learn and also, to see what is.
And also realize that, yes, the propagandists are going to put out the worst and the most terrible shock value pictures that they can. And then when the industry or the people that are in those pictures respond, they're going to minimize it as much as possible. So you have to strike a balance someplace in there. So it's horrible, yes, to see videos of chicken farms where the people are kicking the chickens across the room while they're killing them. And, you know, that certainly put a lot of money in the animal activists' rights pockets. And then KFC comes out and says, no, this is normal practice. And then they get a bad reputation. But also understand that some of these chickens are a little insane. And this is just their nature. So they might, you know, come running up and attack people, you know, and the propagandists are going to say, oh, they're defending themselves. No, they're just attacking because they can. So there's going to be times when you got to kick them to get them off of you.
Well, and again, that comes down to the whole concept of balance at this time of year, really, is the idea that you do have to take a look at every issue from both sides in order to come up with the proper viewpoint on it, whether that is, you know, that you've decided you're going to be vegan or whether you're not. It is a matter of learning. I mean, this happens if you mass produce animals. any of their genetic or their inherent neurological, you know, whatever sort of problems
mad
are going
cow
to
disease.
Surface, you know.
Mad cow disease, yeah.
You're dealing with masses. You're dealing with, like, overpopulations in small places. So, you know, things that are – the diseases are going to be more prevalent and more contagious because mm-hmm. they are there. But at the same time, because you've got these creatures who are mass-produced, you do have the issue of, you know, any sort of defects in their – neurological structure in their bodies are going to be more and more pronounced because they're producing more and more offspring. So, you know, yes, there are going to be like insane animals that because of the way they were created are, you know, unfortunately, you know, that way. And mm-hmm. the only thing in, I mean, okay, natural law says that if something is defective, does not work properly, it will be destroyed.
Right.
This is the way of things in nature. You can't find animals in nature that will allow a defective, dangerous beast to remain among their numbers. They
right.
will oust them. They will kill them. They will get rid of the defect.
And that's one of the big things that I have a problem with a lot of the anti-hunting group, is the fact that these people are, you know, hunting is a terrible thing and should never, ever, 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 ever be done. And what they don't realize is that hunting actually serves a very good purpose. And a lot of it is that it does thin down the herds. It does get rid of some of the problems. It does get rid of, you know, things that nature doesn't always have time to take over and do. What I have a problem with is the trophy hunters, where they go out because they want to rack, and that's it. And that's invariably true. The trophy hunters are also the ones that take the best and the healthiest and the greatest and the most and the strongest and then leave the rest to rot. And good hunters, stewardship hunting, subsistence hunters, they will take anything that they can get. You have a sick, diseased, wolf out there, yeah, a predator's gonna kill it in a second because it can't run very fast. It's hurting, and that's the point of that, is to take the ones that are sick, the ones that are hurt, the ones that are genetically a failure, and get rid of them and get them out of the gene pool, replace them with the ones that are healthy and who are succeeding, so that they can continue on the genes, okay? A lot of hunters, because they don't want to get the diseases that those animals have, will take healthy. They'll try to take the bachelors that have lost their bid for supremacy in the herd. They will try to take ones that are past breeding age, and that's great, and I fully support that kind of hunting. I don't support a lot of the sport hunting because they put too much emphasis on let's take the best and greatest just to get the rack. And in a couple of cases, yeah, they will use the meat and the bones and such afterwards. But you got to, in my opinion, you have to go into any situation like that where you are planning on using everything, so that if you take the king stag with the huge rack, and yes, you're going to mount it on your wall, and boy, it looks beautiful and everything. You have a place where you can put the meat. You have a place where you can use the bones for various tools or items or accent pieces. And you go out of your way to make sure that you thank the spirit of the deer, because far too many people, in my opinion, don't think that they're superior to nature, not part of it, supernatural, if you will. and don't realize that just because we have lots and lots and lots and lots of tools, and we have lots of things like opposable thumbs and language, that we're not part of the natural order. As we joked last episode, guess what? Worms are going to eat you. The grass are going to use your nutrients to grow from. And you're part of
the... animals are going to eat the grass. I mean,
you're part of the cycle, no matter. Yeah, it's the way things are designed. And this is a good thing. So our philosophy as pagans, as natural workers, as primitive worshippers of the earth, should be to fit ourselves into that cycle completely, not pull ourselves separate from it simply because we have bigger and better ways to kill each other. And it should be about making sure that others understand this. And thankfully, this is changing. There's been a popular movement amongst a lot of hunters lately to make it so that hunting is more about stewardship and about taking what needs to be destroyed, because let's be honest here, we've gone out and destroyed all the predators that would normally take care of the rabbit population and the deer population, and so we have to take their place in the grand scheme of things and become those predators in order to keep the balance. But then you have a show like Duck Dynasty coming along where it's aggrandized, and yes, they eat the turkey, but it's this whole industry about hunting. And the hunting is the point. It's not the harvesting. So.
It's true. Well, and I mean, you get that sense too if you... Okay, I happen to be a fan of the movie, but if you see the movie Avatar, you kind of see how Earth cultures view the world they live in. They are part of it. They're not above or somehow better than it. It's become a human tendency to believe that we are beyond the capacity, because we do have literature, because we have philosophy, we have self-awareness, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, that's marvelous. You know, yes, we have those capacities, but we are also unavoidably a part of nature. We are subject to disease and death and birth defects and all kinds of crazy stuff that other animals on this planet are part of. You know, there's no getting around that. Medicine will attempt to control things, but nature in its rather interesting and balanced wisdom tends to say, well, okay, you can control certain things, but I'm going to introduce other things that completely throw you off.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we get like resistant diseases and that sort of thing. I mean,
yeah,
we can only take our ability to heal so far, because sometimes there are things that are meant to take life. This is just how it goes.
Just to relate all of this back, we're still talking about Ostara, but we're talking about, this is a perfect opportunity with the Ostara traditions and the Ostara balancing point of the year with the equal night to look at these issues, drag them out, dust them off, discuss them with your family, discuss them with the people in your life, and reaffirm and make extra decisions that this is the way that you want to live your life. Okay, it's fine if you want to be a super modern human and not ever, you know, you go outside and, oh, I've got nature on my hands. I have nature on my hands. Get me a wipe. I need to get the nature off, you know.
The bottle of hand sanitizer I carry in my pocket for this very purpose.
Yes.
I've touched pollen. No!
It's coming at me and it's sneezing. Yeah, that's fine if you want to do that. There's nothing wrong with it. We need people like that to continue. We also need the farmers who grow the food, who are involved everywhere. and responsible in quite a literal, direct way of keeping human life on this planet going. We need the people who, you know, decry the excesses of factory farms. We need people who, you know, deliver the pizzas to your door. We need everybody. Okay, so nobody's disposable. Nobody's able to be thrown out. Brian and I are not saying that you should immediately go out and forswear any food and be a breatharian because, you know, you're killing things by breathing. What we're saying is make the decision one way or the other and stick to it and be the best of that that you can be. If you want to be a steward of the earth and of the animals, then be a good steward. Understand how humans fit in. Understand how that animal fits in. And, you know, don't go around screaming about how horrible and cruel hunters are when they're, you know, taking the place of all the predators that were killed off. You know, yes, put down the hunters that are going out on safari and bringing back a rhino horn because that's what they wanted to get. But, you know, don't put down the people that are actually doing a good job. Understand what their position is and what they're doing. And I've my brain shut down. Well, that's the point of this episode.
Well, exactly. And I think, too, that, like, just generally, I mean, the idea, I think what really helps at this time of year is to, because you have nature available, go out into parks, you know, experience the cycles of nature. I mean, it's not all about learning about where your food is coming from, although that is probably a really responsible kind of thing to do with your time.
It's one of the best basic things that you can do, simply due to the fact that so many people are convinced that food comes from a supermarket.
Well, exactly. And unfortunately, a lot of kids really don't know where their food comes from. They've never seen things like how animals are raised or, you know, how gardens grow. I mean, I remember growing up as a kid spending summers with my grandparents and just picking random vegetables off the vine when they were ready and just eating them. And mm-hmm. there might be dirt on them. I don't think there were bugs, but there might have been bugs on them. You know, we'd pull carrots straight out of the ground or split pea pods and just snack on the peas fresh out of the pod, mm-hmm. you know. And I don't think a lot of kids get to see that anymore.
Now they think blackberries come in little containers that have no thorns and don't realize that going out and picking them is a real hazard to your health.
It's true, though. Blackberries do come in little pine.
No, I know that I've raised my daughter, but I've also gotten to be a participant in the raising of several other people, not only my sisters, but other people's children and things like that. And one of the things that's so hard for a child to conceive of after a little bit is that animals are food. As an example. One of the dragons that I know that I've been working with is a fairly young one. He's only about 150 years old, but he's never really been exposed to where food comes from. And not too long ago, he was out playing in a field with his dog, and the dog scared up a rabbit. And instinct took over. He jumped after it and, you know, ate it. And then was absolutely horrified that he did this. Because a rabbit is an animal that is nice and it's fluffy and it runs around. It's not a food source. And it was traumatic for him. And we've been having to go through, you know, many, many days of, okay, you know, it's a rabbit. Yeah, where do you think we get rabbit skins from? Where do you think we get Hassenpfeffer from? This is, you know, part of the cycle of nature. You're part of that cycle, and he's still not over it. Going out and figuring and exposing the children to this beforehand, once they make the connection that the burger that is at the supermarket, I'm not going to say one of the big burger companies because that's not really, that's not really burgers. once they make that connection, it's like, oh, okay, this comes from Kyle. Cool, tastes good, and you know, keep eating. It won't be as much of a traumatic thing. And that's one of the big traumatic traumas that I know, childhood traumas that I know everybody goes through, because we are separate from how it comes about.
And I mean, something that, you know, parents can do to help their kids become aware of where food comes from is to do simple things like growing tomato plants in the window, or, you know, on the patio if you happen to have one. You know, take simple steps. Get out there and learn about growing some vegetables that are available in your area or that will grow well in your area. You know, if you happen to have friends who live in the country, you know, take your kids out to see whatever animal being prepared for the meal for that night. You know, whatever. I mean, it's just... It becomes so much easier to put other people down for the way they eat when you yourself aren't aware of where food comes from. And actually, there's a really interesting quote that I've had to use more than once on my blog, because of, you know, preachy people that are critical of how others eat. And this is from a book called something or other. It's like a course on yoga and Kriya by Swami Satyananda Saraswati. And it says, if we are able to choose to be vegetarian, and I've added, or vegan, or non-vegetarian, then we are fortunate. Diet for much of the world's population is often more of a matter of eating what is available than being able to choose a particular diet from a whole variety of foods. In some cases, all that is available is meat. For example, Eskimos, Inuit, through absolute necessity, traditionally, eat an exclusive diet of flesh. Are we to accuse the Eskimos of immoral habits because of their situation? On the other hand, people in other parts of the world are too poor to include meat in their diet. Are these people to be praised for being moral or being vegetarians when they are merely following the dictates of necessity? So if you have the good fortune to be able to choose your eating habits, realize that it is a privilege and be sure not to condemn others for not eating the same food as you do.
Cool. Yes, that is something that needs to be remembered. I mean, because he's right. You shouldn't condemn without knowledge. And that's the point of just about everything, is understanding that you are not them, they are not you. Choices that you have made in your life for you are only relevant to you. And ultimately, somebody else's path is their path and not yours. And you cannot make those choices for them. Okay? And so that relates back to Ostara very simply. We have a situation where this is a celebration of the fertility of the earth. This is the time when things start growing, when we start obtaining the ability to get whatever, okay? So, yeah, divinations, magics for abundance increase are always very good. And understanding where you are. You know, I'm going mentally reviewing this episode, and we're harping on, you know, understanding food and everything like that. But that's what this is all about. You know, the entire year we have celebrations of fertility in Ostara and Beltania. We have celebration of the woman at Letha, or no, Ostara, Beltania, and Letha are, you know, fertility celebrations. Lucnada is the celebration of all things woman. Then we have harvest festivals at Mabon, Samhain, and in some cases Yule can be as celebration of the same. And then we've got the celebration of everything that's man at Imbolc. And the cycle goes around. So, you know, the whole focus of the pagan celebrations, at least at this point, in the paganism that we're trying to perpetuate in Wicca and some of the northern traditions and things like that are based on this cycle. This is central to the beliefs. So don't be afraid of actually examining that stuff and where you stand in relation to it. I mean, you don't have to go out and fuck in a field at Beltanya just because it's the 1st of May, but you can, you know, do things to help your local area, like going out and fertilizing a garden, like going out and making a decision that you're going to take the necessary slaughtered animals for your food, and checking that and making sure that, you know, there's not a lot of pesticides used in your food, and demanding that we eat in a certain way, or that you eat in a certain way, and then telling the producers of that you want what they have and paying them for it. I mean, those are things that fit well with this cycle that is not, you know, go out and slaughter your own cattle and, you know, chop it up for hamburgers and then go out and grow the wheat and make the bread and turn it into a bun just so that you can sit down and have a Sunday dinner of hamburgers. That's
exactly,
you know, it's little things, little bitty pieces, little changes that you can make in your life to make things better. Mary wants to get us on getting the local produce boxes. A lot of areas these days offer local farm growers, a co-op, to sell their products through. And you'll get a box like once every week, once every 2 weeks, of absolutely farm fresh vegetables. With, you know, eggs and milk right out of the cow that's not homogenized, where all the cream is mixed into it, so that you have, you know, the chunk of cream floating on top of the bottle. You know, and this is something that, you know, a lot of people are really getting into now. And this is a great thing to do. So, you know, go get something like that.
It actually is pretty cool. Because actually a few years ago when I was living in a certain small town, it's called Penticton, and it's like in this area where they basically have gardens and orchards and stuff all over the place. And I actually was doing like the local weekly produce bucket thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there'd be like fresh root vegetables. I mean, during the winter, unfortunately, pickings get a little slim. So you're dealing with like softened root vegetables and, you know, things that are aging. But, you know, through the spring, especially in spring and early summer, I mean, you're getting produce of all kinds that's brilliant colors and, you know, it's fresh. And depending on, you know, the program that you're on, I mean, it can be delivered to your door, basically. Mm-hmm. But it really is an amazing sort of process. I mean, just to see the variety of things that people are growing in your area and to be part of that whole cycle. Because of the fact that you do have options sometimes where you're just getting a mix of whatever's available as opposed to ordering specific items, although usually you can do that. You do get to try new vegetables and things, and with, you know, all the recipe websites out there, I mean, you can look up recipes that you may never, ever have thought to try before, because you might one week get an eggplant in your basket, and you've never tried eggplant before. Or you might get leeks, and you've never eaten leeks before, or fennel, or whatever. And, you know, it offers you that chance to try new things that you've never, ever conceived of before, because you may not have grown up eating fennel and leeks and eggplant and whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've never had a lot of those things. in a very literal sense, I can't eat them now. I was never exposed to the good versions of it. It was always quick and easy and throw it into the pot and boil it to death so that all the nutrients were out of it. And I learned to detest vegetables. as a result of that, I grew up not eating vegetables, eating lots and lots and lots of protein, lots and lots of carbs, lots of starches, rice and corn and peas and things like that, and beef almost constantly. And so I'm having real problems now. I'm 46 years old. I've got nutrition deficits because I haven't been getting the nutrition from the vegetables that I normally would. I've got lots of protein. I'm fat, obese because I don't have the fiber going through me, pulling all of that out. And I'm missing most of my teeth. And now I'm in a position where I can't chew vegetables. Because if you look at our teeth, the teeth are designed to be cutting teeth in the front and piercing, stabbing steak knives just outside of that. And then from the canines back, they're shredding machines. Well, the chopping, cutting ones are protein eaters and meat eaters. The stabby ones are also, you know, for...
I like that term.
Well, they are. I mean, you know, the vampires, and they stab, and they, you know, cut open, and the canines.
That's right.
Those are, you know, meat eaters, but the grindy ones, the molars and such, those are plant eaters. We are omnivores. And at this point, I can't eat vegetables because I lack the capacity to chew them. It's not that I can't. So I'm having to take, you know, six different types of supplements and vitamins in order to make up for the nutrition that I'm not getting through the plants. And that's bad in and of itself because most of the commercial vitamins that are out there are, you know, you're supposed to take them one a day and that's the only thing you're supposed to take. And so they mega load you with, you know, vitamin B1835. And it gives you 800 times the amount you're supposed to get for one day, you know, and so you get health problems from that too. So,
true.
You know, and
I mean, the whole system of particular aspects of diet too. There are certain things that animals get out of, like cats. I mean, they get certain vitamins out of the innards and, you know, out of the blood and out of the stomach contents of the things they eat, in at least in nature. Sometimes the commercially available food doesn't have the equivalent nutritional value because they use too much grain or corn or whatever to fill out the product. And, you know, so there's problems with the way things are made nowadays. And actually, if you look at the average supermarket, if you guys want to see a couple of really great documentaries that are really informative, check out King Corn and Food Inc. Those are brilliant. And it will blow your mind just how much stuff is made of something like corn. Because it's not just, you know, like cornmeal. It's not like blatantly obvious stuff. It's used as sweetener, as preservative, as like filler. It's a starch content for some things and on it goes. And you basically, you're just like, you look at the average meal that someone might be eating and there's probably half of it has corn in it somehow. And that might be in syrup or like, the corn itself, or it might be the starch in a certain bread product or whatever. And it's just like, wow, we have so screwed up our natural eating process by trying to mass produce food that is low quality, just for the sake of making it cheaper. And yet at the same time, you've got, because of the fact that corn is, oh God, what's the word? Subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes cheaper, but it's artificial because it actually costs considerably more to produce than a lot of farmers are getting for actually, like, if it wasn't subsidized, there would be a lot of farmers going bankrupt mm-hmm. who raised corn because it is so, so heavily subsidized.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so the lack of nutrition is just probably a common problem all over the place because we aren't producing the food that is healthy. It's just available. It's kind of like handfuls of sawdust instead of, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does get really ridiculous really quickly. And so this time period, more than anything else, is a good chance for you to get in and think about this and to look at it and to find out what you believe and what you want to perpetuate amongst the next generation, and to discuss things like this. Because, I mean, let's face it, the choice to go from being an omnivore to being a vegetarian or a vegan or whatever flavor you want is a huge life-changing decision. It affects you in so many ways that you just don't know. And it not only affects you, but it affects the people around you, too. Because now they have to keep this in mind and keep your dietary restrictions as a thought in their brain all the time. I mean, I don't know about you, but Mary and I, you know, have this thing. Okay, we're driving along, and oh, there's a fast food joint. We're hungry. Let's go in and get it. Okay, so we go in and get it and eat it and whatever, and we don't think about it. But if you become a vegan, you know, your husband's driving down the road with you sitting in the passenger side, and he sees, a Denny's or something, and he's got to make a choice now of going into a restaurant where there's food available for you to eat, or to go to the fast food joint that's across the street that's got a drive-thru, where you are either not going to be eating anything, or you're going to be forced to eat something that you don't want. You know, and just plain courtesy is going to be coming in, you know, all the time. And that's a life change for him, one that he hasn't made.
Yeah, definitely.
You know.
And I think, I mean, that's one of the things where you really have to develop. I mean, not only do you have to develop compassion as a consumer, you have to be conscious of what you're dealing with. But you also have to realize that compassion isn't just about animals. I mean, it's about people. It's about, like, every aspect of your life, basically. If you want to be vegan, all the power to you. I really, really wanted to for a long time. There are days, like, I kind of think I want to do it in this cyclical thing during the spring and summer when the produce is available and cheap. But, you know, at the same time, there's a lot of people who look down on me for, you know, thinking seasonally, primarily because, well, it should affect your entire life all year round. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's a part of me that kind of says, well, what about the ecological impact of my importing the goods so that I can be a vegan through fall and winter, which wouldn't naturally be available, you know, at this time of year. Mm-hmm. Like, so, I mean, there's a whole pile of things that connect, you know, that you have to think about. And spring equinox is a really good time for that, because this is the kind of the time when you want to be thinking about whether you want to plant flowers in your garden, or you want to plant vegetables in there, or a mix of them, or, you know, if you want to get in touch with a herbalist or, you know, a homeopath or what have you. And kind of make yourself conscious of the things that are out there that tie to nature's cycles. I mean, because as a herbalist, and I'm only learning myself, you do have to be able to learn when certain plants grow and what they look like at different times of year. You know, you have to learn kind of the cycles when a plant is at its most vital, at its most effective. in order to
be an effective herbalist. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And I mean, like, there are certain things that you can harvest, like nettles. If you harvest it too late in the year, it becomes dried out, and it's kind of lost its food value. It's lost its, like, medicinal value and all this. If you harvest it too early, it's probably brilliant as food, as a salad green or whatever. Can't say as I've eaten young nettles before, but, you know, I mean, it becomes an issue of knowing when in the year it's at its best for what you need it for. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, you know, as a beginning gardener, that you would have to consider as well when you're growing food.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's face it, it's nice to get out when the earth is waking up and going, hey, I'm here, you know, after being cooped up in the house for months, listen to me.
It's true.
So going out true. And seeing all these places, you know, it revitalizes everything. I don't know about y'all, but my favorite times of the year are spring and fall. Spring, because yeah. everything is just bursting with life and going crazy and jumping all around and up and down, and you can feel it. It's like this electric tension in the air, and it's absolutely wonderful, in my opinion. Fall, everything is, you know, slowing down, and they're getting ready, and it's like that time period right before you actually get into bed and cuddle up in your blankets and everything and start to shut down to go to sleep. You know, those are those two times of year. Those are, you know, they wake me up. They're wonderful for me. I love them. But
well, and one that's of the thing with me too. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say one of the regrets that I have is that I do live in a very urban area where we don't get out into nature and take just walks in the park. One of the things that I loved to do when I was a teen would be go camping. And this is just, you know, going out and walking through the wildlife preserves where the trees haven't been cut down, where there may be paths there that people have walked and seen, and there's campsites and things like that. But for the most part, the animals, you know, are around. You can see them. They'll come into your campsite. They're not screened off from you. You can sleep under the stars. There's not ground light around to mess you up with everything. I love that, you know, and it's a regret that I haven't been able to do it for about 20 years. And that's mostly because mm-hmm. of me. But anyway, go ahead, Brian.
Well, and I mean, speaking to that same sort of seasonal thing, I mean, for me, my mind is most active in spring. Like, this is the time of year when I'm like, bursting with creative ideas and like the desire to just go out and do everything and learn everything. And then, you know, come fall, probably typically around, the autumn equinox and heading into like, Samhain, it becomes kind of a slowing down for my mental processes. It's almost like my brain is preparing to hibernate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, suddenly it goes into a very deeply contemplative period of time where, you know, I'm considering mortality and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's true. Like every year I go through the same cycle, and then, you know, I just get very contemplative and, you know, right into the depth of winter, I'm just barely able to function mentally. Like, you know, I'm just not interested in reading heavy stuff and so on. So, you know, it's a seasonal thing. And growing up, especially during my major periods of being interested in shamanism, I always connected myself to bears as kind of a totem or, you know, guardian spirit kind of thing, because of the fact that I was, you know, experiencing similar seasonal sort of cycles of energy and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I mean, this time of year is just like, I'm giddy and eager to get out and do stuff. And it's just like, it's a weird and unique experience. Like, if I don't know, it's just hard to like put into words. But I'm just like, the sun is out, and I'm like, ah, and so on.
Okay, one word of caution that I'm going to come in with is something that a lot of people probably are not going to think about. There was a major a popular movement to get kids outside playing like we used to when we were like 8, 9, 10, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And, you know, to get them away from the electronic devices, get them physically moving, and that's great as far as that goes. Here's the problem now. When I was little, at least, and summer would come along, I'd spend most of the summer outside, biking from place to place, going from here to there, doing whatever, playing in the trees, climbing, stuff like that. It was a different time at that point. There weren't people that were going and kidnapping kids off the street. I mean, there were, but you weren't hearing about it on a daily basis.
Guns. Well, I think that's the big issue, though. Like, you hear more about those things all the time on, like, the news and on the internet and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you're hearing more about it, even if it's in a remote corner of, like, I don't know.
The world?
Say, well, I mean, the world generally, but I mean, in some remote corner of your own country, like, if you hold on to that, you build up this fear that's unnecessary, right? Like, because the odds are so remote, but because of the available media that says, these are the dangers your entire family faces every minute of every day, suddenly you build this fear, and it's like creating something that, out of nothing. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of this woman who runs a website called Free Range Kids. Can't remember her name right now for the life of me. But she kind of was like, she made the news back in like the early 2000s or something because her 9-year-old son wanted to ride the subway in New York City. Mm-hmm. And she was a single mother, and she's, you know, she's like, yeah, sure, go for it. You know, he knew how to get home, right? And because she had trusted that her 9-year-old could get through New York City on the subway, you know, and made it home alive, suddenly it was like a big thing. So she started a blog basically discussing this. And she wrote a book too. Can't remember what it's called. But, you know, she
we'll
basically
find it and link it. Kind
of, yeah, absolutely. She basically talks about this very sort of media-created fear. And she personally doesn't understand why so many parents are afraid, because it's not like the dangers – like, there's not 1,000 cars aiming to run down your child. Like, I don't know. Growing up, we used to play street hockey, and mm-hmm. if a car came, we'd go, hold up, car, and then we'd move aside. You know, it was like – there was common sense to things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we also grew up in a time where we didn't wear bike helmets. And hell, we were, like, riding without holding the handlebars and shit like that. So,
yeah. You fall down, you skin your knees. Skin knees were were a permanent condition amongst most people during the summer.
Well, and like Galena said in our Yule episode, or in our Northern Tradition episode, sorry, you know, you learn to survive. I mean, you learn that you were capable of recovery from minor injuries. Mm-hmm. By the way, I think we should have Galena on sometime in the next month or two, because she would be fun.
We'll work on it. Anyway, my point was that take some common sense along with that. The kids these days have been raised indoors. They've been raised with central heat and air.
Yeah.
So used to conditions where it's like 68. You know, you push them outside. I mean, when I grew up, my grandparents' car didn't have air conditioning in it. So whenever I went anyplace with them, we had to roll down all the windows. It was 270.
Oh,
AC.
Yeah.
Yep. 270 AC. two windows down, 70 miles an hour. And, you know, so that readjusted your internal thermostat and temperature sense in a different way so that you could stand being out in 80 and 90 degree weather all day as long as you were in the shade. Mm-hmm. And you could play and you didn't sweat. These days, you take a kid that's been, you know, raised inside, goes from one air-conditioned environment, runs to another air-conditioned environment, to be driven to another air-conditioning environment, to come home in that same air-conditioning environment, and you shove them out in 85-degree weather, which, I promise you, is not that hot. They're going to have heat stroke.
Yeah, they're going to, like, have heat stroke and sunburn and all this kind of stuff because we've become a culture that raises kids sheltered from nature.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've indoctrinated our own selves basically with this idea that nature is bad, that getting out in the sun, I remember being a kid personally and knowing a ton of kids who were my friends who we would go shirtless all summer and we would have like red peeling sunburns and that was like no big deal. I mean, nowadays, you know, slather your child with like SPF 900, you know, to put them out in the sun for 10 minutes a day. And I don't know. It just seems really weird to me that we would be so afraid of it because the whole concept of getting out in the sun, I mean, your body's designed to do that. Like, it has melanin that will darken your skin.
Mm-hmm. That's what a tan
enough.
Is.
And, you know, your body learns to cope with that. But if you hide from the fact and, you know, you shelter yourself against nature, then your body actually adjusts itself accordingly. And, you know, I happen to be the type of person who wears shorts even through the winter. In the Pacific Northwest, people are kind of weirded out because it's cold and damp and windy. But, you know, this is just something I do. Like, when I was a scout, we wore shorts all year. And it didn't matter if it was freezing and your knees went red. You would wear your shorts and your little stockings and your garter tabs and all that stuff. Because that was just the way it was. Nowadays, and, you know, back when I was a scout leader too, you dealt with kids who were basically indoor children. You know, they would wear pants as uniform clothing. And they would, you know, all their activities were focused on, you know, what can we do to sit indoors and be sheltered and comfortable? And even the idea of camping involved like this insane amount of equipment and, you know, comfort gear and all this kind of crap. And it was like, really though, do you really need to have your entire life built around pure comfort? Like, does being out camping have to feel like you're at home? once you get to a certain age, I mean, I understand that, you know, I understand the desire for comfort, but I don't know, as kids, I think it helps to teach your kids that they're resilient. You know, like, mm-hmm. Yes, you can feel a little bit of a chill. You can get goosebumps and you won't die. You know, you can get a sunburn and nothing's going to happen to you. Like,
and it's interesting,
your body will heal.
Right. And it's interesting because what winds up happening is that the reverse becomes the same. I don't know about y'all, but I hate winter mainly for the cold. I mean, I enjoy being right around 68 to 72 degrees. That's my comfort zone. And that tends to be a lot of people's comfort zones, too. But I'll see, you know, the wind whipping around outside and find out it's 50-some-odd degrees out there, and I'll go out without a coat. And that's fine. what will happen is that, yes, I'll shiver and shake for the first 10 minutes or so. I'll get really cold, hands will get numb, nose will get numb, and then it's almost like some switch gets flipped in my body, and I stop shivering. I stop being cold. It's still the same temperature. The wind is still blowing, but I'm not feeling the immediate effects anymore. And I could be out like that for the next 3-4 hours. It's not the beginning stages of frostbite. It's not the beginning of hypothermia. It's that my internal thermostat readjusted itself so that it's okay to be cold and to cool the body temperature down somewhat and still be able to function, you know?
Actually, it's funny because the first thing that comes to mind when you say that is there's a book that I own that I happen to love. And I think, you know, it's one that if you want to get your kid out in nature, it's called Tom Brown's Field Guide to Nature Observation and Tracking. And it talks about exactly these kind of things, like the fact that cold is just something you get used to, you know. And there's a quote from that book that he says, welcome and embrace minor discomforts and they will cease to be a bother, or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's been a while since I read it. But yeah, I mean, like, the simple truth is if you go out and you let yourself experience those things instead of building up the fear of them in your head, then you won't even notice them after a while. Like, it's all about mental programming. And that sense that you're freezing is really just it's something you've built in your own head. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are scared to go barefoot for the same reason. They've built up in their head that, oh my God, I'm going to cut my feet open on glass and rusty nails and all this kind of stuff. But at the same time, if you're kind of conscious and you go barefoot, you naturally avoid things that hurt your feet, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to go stomping on shards of broken glass and, you know, rusty nails and things like that for kicks.
Right. Well,
some people might, but the idea is that your body will adapt to that condition, right?
Mm-hmm. And the souls
and
will toughen up.
You'll be able to experience it. Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And
yeah, my thing is that my feet are a little sensitive, and it seems like every tiny little pebble just is excruciating, and I'm not willing to, you know, I like going barefoot, but I've got poor circulation in my feet now, so I can't for very long because my feet start getting really, really cold, and I mean cold to the touch. So, you know, I have to wear shoes and socks and stuff like that. And then there's the plantar fasciitis. So, you know, so be reasonable about it. Take the precautions that you need to for your comfort, but don't be afraid of a little discomfort. Because, I mean, the concept of being warm in the winter and being cool in the summer is a relatively new concept given the history of humanity. Air conditioning, you know, wasn't invented really reliably until like the 1950s. So it's only been within the last 60 years that we've had this. Three entire generations have grown up with it, yes. But you're talking about 6,000 years or more of human history where they didn't have it, where what they had was a fan and the wind and, you know,
and shade. I mean, human beings take advantage of shade because that's sort of what animals do. I mean, if it's sunny, go in the shade where it's cooler.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I thought was just incredible was stories have started coming out of Afghanistan and various places in the Mideast like that of vendors selling ice cream, okay? And the way that they do it is not with expensive ice cream machines or freezers or anything like that. They take one pot, they load the ice cream into it that's already made, they put it inside of another pot, they put sand around in the gap between the two pots and then fill that with water. Okay? Mm-hmm. And
evaporation coolers.
Evaporation coolers are extremely efficient, and it keeps the ice cream frozen And I was like, you have got to be kidding me, because it's just sitting there. There's no power to it. But with a slight breeze over the outside of the pot, wicking away the moisture that has seeped in out of where the sand is at, then that cools that cools the sand around it and brings the temperature down so far that really perishable things stay fine for hours in 120 degree heat. It was like, you've got to be flipping kidding me. And this is a technology that's been around for centuries, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, it brings to mind something that I think a lot of families would really enjoy at this time of year too, especially once it gets into summer. The idea of a solar oven made out of a cardboard box and some tin foil and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can find directions all over the internet on how to do that. But baking normal food in something's powered by the sun is a mind-blowing experience, because most people are like, I'm going to go to the kitchen and turn on the stove and then I'll have food. Whereas making something that out of the heat of the sun, which is a constant source of heat aside from the winter, which obviously, you know, is a different matter. It's just such a weird new experience that a lot of people, I think, don't get to have. It takes longer than, you know, your conventional mod cons kind of deal, but...
And that's the thing. People don't use it because it does take longer and it's not as convenient. But here's the thing. As long as the reason that you have spare time to surf the internet and listen to podcasts like this is because of all the modern conveniences where you don't have to boil your water, where you don't have to go out to the privy to that's 20 yards away from the house to go to the bathroom, where you know, you have
True.
A stove that you can cook a soup on instead of leaving it over the fire all day.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I personally, I'm really fond of the whole romantic idea of having a hearth that you just have, like, burning all day or whatever, and leaving a pot of soup that just sits there and stays warm all day, and, mm-hmm. you know, you go to it when you're hungry. And I know people who've done that, like, who live in, like, wood stove log cabins and basically, like, leave a pot of coffee on the stove all day, or they leave, you know, a stew or something like that, and they just add to it as, you know, as it gets more, like, used up. And it seems so weird nowadays, like, because everyone's used to this idea of eating different things every meal. My roommate's the same way. Like, she's of the sort of, she's programmed to think that every single meal has to be different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every day is going to be a different thing. And she doesn't eat leftovers, ever.
I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I'll make a huge pot of chili and munch on it for 2-3 days straight. And Mary does not understand. Mary does not understand how I can eat the same meal more than twice. And it's like... But I don't eat leftovers.
I know exactly what that's like, because I have a big pot of split pea soup that I made the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I ate it for dinner that night, and yesterday I had the option of eating it, and, you know, I'm fine with doing that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's weird at all.
I do it with red beans and rice a lot. The Zatarain's, you add beef to it, and I'll cook up a double batch and have this meal and, you know, just be sitting on the stove for several hours, and then when I get hungry again in a couple hours, I'll go back and have another portion of it, you know?
Yup. See, and I think a lot of people are just not used to doing that. Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
It's the convenience factor.
It's just a cultural thing now.
It's become a convenience factor. We've become such a melting pot and such a polyglot, and there's such a thrust towards multiculturalism, and that we think that we do have to have multiple meals and have it all be different. But I'll tell you, if you want to connect with your ancestors, especially with the farming ancestors, what wound up happening was, you know, back in, I don't know, the 1100s, 1200s, they would, you know, get up and have a cold meal from the night before, leftovers. And then the wife would get up and they would make breakfast, okay? And it would be a large breakfast, you know, bacon, eggs, breads, things like that. And for 11s, they would come back and they would eat on that while she's fixing, you know, stuff for lunch and dinner. And she would cook the main things, the breads, the soups and the stews and the meats and the roasts during that time period. And you would have what would wind up happening is you would have a cold meal in the very beginning of the morning, a hot meal a couple of hours after that, a cold meal as a snack, a hot meal as the midday snack or the midday meal, then another cold meal in between those, tea, then another hot meal, dinner, and then, you know, a snack before you went to bed. And that was the cycle. That's where the 7 meals a day of the hobbits came from, literally, is that cycle of eating. Because that's...
Well,
I mean,
and I think... Sorry, go ahead.
If you just read in the books that Tolkien was talking about, that's exactly the cycle. They have a meal when they first tumble out of bed, and it's not anything big. It's a, you know, slice of bread, some jam, some butter on it, something just to get their metabolism moving, something from last night, and then they actually have a hot meal a couple of hours later after they've gone out and milked the cows and gathered the eggs and, you know, done this before they start the main work of the day. And then they get the hot meal, and that's a big sit down thing, and you know that really gets all their metabolism moving. They, you know, when they get hungry somewhere around 11 o'clock or so, because they've been working for 2 hours in the field, they come back and they'll have, you know, a biscuit, a sandwich, something small, something just to keep them going, and then they'll have the big hot meal in the middle of the day at lunch, 1 o'clock. And then,
well, and one of the best, sorry.
No, it's,
I mean,
it's
one of the,
go ahead.
One of the best examples I can think of is the Amish, right? Like even the quote modern Amish, they do that kind of thing where food is produced, you know, basically every day kind of thing. And, you know, they're up early to start the bread or whatever that they need for the day. They might cook it for a couple of days or whatever, but basically the food they need is produced as it's needed, and it's not expected in a hurry. It's not, you know, it's not going to be like a quick thing where, you know, bam, you add water to a boxed bread mix or whatever, and it comes out, you know, in an hour out of the oven or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And it's
the same processes.
It was a big sit down thing because that's when all the dishes were ready. You know, you didn't, like Brian said, you didn't have the bam, it's ready right out of the oven. You couldn't stick the popcorn in the microwave, and so you couldn't snack on that away from the rest of your family members. Mom had to sit down with the popcorn maker and the popcorn kernels and over the fire, and, you know, it would pop in the thing, and then when it was ready was when it was ready. You know, so, and then everybody comes and snacks on it. So, you know, people decline
that. Well,
that's
the thing.
You know.
I think the attitude toward even snacking has changed so much now because, like, food is convenient and available all the time. It's become easy to basically overconsume it.
Mm-hmm.
And
add to that the convenience factor of modern machinery not making tasks less labor intensive. We're not working as hard and we're not burning as much energy.
That's true too. I mean, you look at a typical Amish meal and they're eating like
5,000
sausages and all kinds of great looking food. But it's because they constantly work through the day. Like their entire food related dynamic is adjusted to the lifestyle they lead.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest things
that I ever saw was there was a PBS special here in the States at least called the Frontier House. And it
loved
was
it.
Do you remember this?
I
basically
do.
Three couples with various kids went out and were put in a situation like they would be breaking the territories open and moving into a territory new and having to survive. They lived there for, I think, something like 6 months, and they had to, you know, the tools and the items and the way of life that their ancestors had. Well, one of the families that was there was this fairly well-off couple who made like $150,000 a year, had air conditioning, had two kids, and they're living in a one-room house, log cabin, literally, now. And, you know, all of them were overweight. The father, worst of all, he was, you know, probably pushing 230 pounds or something, and the doctor was getting on to him about having too much weight. About halfway through the series, they, you know, took him to the hospital because he was starving to death, according to him. He had lost so much weight that he was now underweight, and he was eating so much. I mean, he was finding everything to eat that he possibly could and consuming it, and still he was dropping weight. And he didn't know what the hell was going on, and I'm screaming at the TV going, "You're working! That's what's going on. You're burning 10,000 calories a day using your scythe to harvest hay for your animals, and you're actually moving and working and doing. And yeah, you're going to drop weight."
Yeah. Well, that series brings to mind a couple of others that were really interesting and very informative in the same kind of respects. The BBC did a couple that were absolutely fantastic. One was called Surviving the Iron Age, mm-hmm. and that was like basically reenacting a Celtic village life.
Oh.
You know, with like the thatched roofs and druidic ceremonies at, you know, various times of year, and Wicker Man and stuff. Mm. And then the other was the 1940s house. And, you know, this is again
loved
modern
that one.
Family dropped into a 40s environment, wartime, basically Britain. And everything for them was so different because in the war periods, you had to make use of limited resources in the most creative ways. You
all
had
rationed.
To, like, getting a cake for someone's birthday wasn't a matter of just going down and buying a box of, you know, Duncan Hines mix. It was like you had to keep your ration tickets in reserve so that you could afford to buy the ingredients to make that cake for that birthday or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was so much more meaningful and important when you had to deal with that lack. And I think now, you know, we bitch all the time about culture and stuff, but the reality is I think there's a different perspective now, and unfortunately, it translates into a lot of entitlement that has never existed, you know, before. I mean,
yeah.
Yes, humanity is healthier now and longer lived and all that, but we've lost a lot of respect for, like, the timing of things, for the availability of things, because everything is available all the time.
Yeah, and I agree with that. It is something that needs to be, you know, looked at and discussed amongst family members mostly. I don't know how many of you who are listening to this have any kind of nightly tradition or weekly tradition. I know the Mormons were very big on doing a sit-down together called Family Home Evening, where you turned off the TV, you unplugged the phone, you shut down your PDA. At the time, you turned off the VIC-20. Now it would be, you know, everybody throws their iPhones and iPads into a closet, and the closet's locked for 3 or 4 hours. But you spent time relating to each other and talking about things. The point of it, when I was growing up at least, was to, give another sermon on Monday night to the family so that we're all, you know, Mormons together. But it's a good, you know, it's a good solid idea simply because, yeah, we do get so scattered. We do get into such a mindset of my life is important and screw everybody else that you don't stop to consider that I'm going to change to a vegan is going to affect another person in your family. You know, you don't think about that because, well, this is your life and you're going to live it. Well, it's going to affect them, so they have a say in it too. You know, and
well,
this would be the time to sit down and do
person.
That. you know. Go ahead.
Well, especially if you're a young person and you want to become vegan because, I don't know, you have friends who are vegan or whatever.
It's the trend of the day.
Well, I didn't want to say that, but yes. I know a young guy who struggled a lot because he wanted to be vegan so badly, and his mom had been vegetarian in the past. So she was okay to a certain point with cooking things that were like outside of the family's normal meal or whatever. But in the end, she kind of said to him, you know, if you want to do something here, you know, here's all the stuff you need. I'm going to buy it for you, but I'm not going to be cooking two meals so that, you know, our family can eat. If you want this food, you make it. And I kind of have to respect him for having to go through that because it is something that a lot of kids aren't familiar with now.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just assume mommy and daddy will cook for them. I know growing up that my sister was pretty much like, I'm not going to cook soup, you know. I don't see why I should do it, you know.
Because you're not going to be living at home anymore and you're going to need to cook your own meals?
Well, exactly. And, like, when I was 10 or 11 years old, I was at, you know, at the stovetop with my mom or dad, whoever happened to be making the soup. Mm-hmm. And I was there, like, involved in the process, you know, mm-hmm. picking the meat off the bones and all that kind of tedious work mm-hmm. that went into it. She still today doesn't do much more than boil water or put stuff in the oven that's been pre-prepared. Like, she buys, her husband is kind of fussy too. So they buy all the, you know, like, prepared frozen food and they just pop it in the oven or and they, you know.
And it's really sad that there's an entire industry made around popping something in an oven so that other people can eat. It's, there was a show, Return to Pleasantville, I think, and it was an idealized 1940s town, and the father came home, and changes were happening in the town. I'm not going to give the whole plot away, but the father would come home, and he would close the door, and he would hang up his hat, and the mother would be there to greet him, and the meal would be on the table, and he sat down, and he'd eat, and he, you know, and that was his day. And he'd go to work the next day and come back. Well, throughout the course of it, at one point, he comes home, mom has left, the sister's gone over to friend's house, and he, you know, walks through the door and closes it, and, honey, I'm home! And there's nothing. There's no greeting. Mm-hmm. So he opens the door again and goes back out, and he comes back in and closes the door. Honey, I'm home! You know, and hangs up his hat, and there's still nothing. And he goes into the kitchen, and it's spotless. And there's no food. And he goes into the dining room, and there's no food. And he finally winds up finding a jar of olives in the refrigerator, and that's his meal for the night, because he doesn't know how to make food. Anyway.
Yeah.
It was hilarious.
I can totally see that happening. I mean, but I think that says a lot about our culture, too. I mean, nowadays, you're less likely to have a meal prepared all at once for the family because everyone's on different schedules and, mm-hmm. and there's not really a set night where people are sitting down together or helping each other out making the food or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing because I think there's a lot of focus on individualism and the individual as a standalone entity. Mm-hmm. And I mean, unfortunately, there's good things about it, but then there's a lot of bad things about it too, because it creates this isolation between people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think it just kind of has a negative impact overall because, you know, everyone's supposed to be this, you know, standalone individual, you know, and then they complain that, you know,
There's
down
no
the line.
Closeness, and we have no relations to each other, and yeah.
Well, exactly. I mean, the negative or problematic relations at home translate into behavior outside the home as well, because mm-hmm. suddenly everyone's just like curt and kind of rude to each other because they're like, well, I'm more important than you are. Why would you do anything that interferes with my life, kind of thing? And I don't know. I guess I'm just bitching and about something that I suppose will never change, but
probably.
It's an individual household thing, I guess.
But as pagans, if we're trying to return to a more primitive time, to a time when we were more connected to the earth, you have to actually make an effort to do this sort of stuff. It's not just the ceremonies, mm-hmm. it's not just the meditations, it's not just reading the books and casting the spells. It's actually going out and deliberately putting yourself in positions where you're going to be inconvenienced, you're going to be hurt, you're going to be discomforted, you're going to be out in nature with other people, you're going to, you know, have to learn to deal with mosquito bites, because they're, guess what, everywhere. You're going to have
True.
To deal with stuff like that, you know, and it's not anything to be scared of. It's just making the decision of it. And, you know, if you want to get back into a classical family where there's closeness there, you have to make an effort to do it. And that's what Astara is all about. So, having gone on for 2 hours about everything under the sun, that's it for this week's episode. Tune in a couple weeks. Right now the plan is that we're going to have the energy work section of the spell crafting that we did 2 weeks ago. So that's going to be interesting when we do it. And, you know, we're available at magicalmusings.net online, as we always are. Joy at magicalmusings.net and Brian at magicalmusings.net are our email addresses. Please talk to us if you want, if you like this show, if you enjoy what we're doing, spread it
if
around.
If you have criticism,
yeah.
Say so. You know,
if,
we want to hear that.
You know, if we've messed up a factual error, please let us know, because we're not all-knowing. You know, we have to do research and stuff like that. Mary,
that's
the research
true.
God, is not here. You know?
And, I mean, realistically, like, we aren't representing every tradition of paganism out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we both have ties to Wicca and Druidry. So those are our main focuses. But at the same time, you know, we each have our own life experiences to draw from as well. So,
which is why we bring on other people that know more than us. Like, I wouldn't even begin to talk about Asatru and the Northern traditions, which is why we got Galena on. Because she knows more about it than
exactly.
we do.
It's true. I mean, I've done a fair bit of reading on it. I've considered it. But, yeah, when it comes to certain things, you just have to bring experts. Mm-hmm. And actually, note for future episode, I wouldn't mind bringing on Reverend Terry Riley, the author of Brothers of the Sun, or Dancing Rabbit, who wrote The Way of the Horned God, something like that.
Well, one thing that we are running into is that authors have their own lives, too. Galena is chomping at the bit to get back on the show.
Lives.
She loved it. Lupa has her own thing that's going on right now. She's very involved with her psychology practice, and so she can't get on immediately. Ray Buckland, he's in the middle of writing several books about Wiccan mystery. It's a mystery with a detective that solves crimes who happens to be Wiccan as well. So it's not Wiccan mysteries.
Yeah, interesting.
Pretty much, yeah. And he's really involved in that, and I've reached out to him a couple times going, hey, you know, please join us. And he's like, well, I'd love to, but. And he's really busy
with that. Oh,
that
would be like such a coup for our little show.
It would be interesting.
Ray Buckland came on. What?
Anyway, so that's the show. please reach out to us, get in touch with us, even if it's just to say, hey, I love your show, you're great, or you got this fact wrong, or, you know, whatever. If we honestly got it wrong, we'll correct it and let everybody know, and you'll probably even be mentioned. If you want to be advertised on our site, let us know. I mean, we have advertising space, and we'll mention you in the show here so that you get traffic driven to you. But anyway, so anything else, Brian? No. Okay.
Joy.
All right.
Joy's at wide-worlds-joy.com.
Tumblr.com. Yeah.
Cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. Mm-hmm.
And those are our personal blogs. So, yeah, give us a ring. Talk to us. We don't bite hard, and then you got to ask us really nice. And we'll talk to you later.
Exactly. Have a good one, folks.